Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. I am so excited for you to listen to this next podcast episode because this one, we go into depth, we go into detail, we're going to break down some myths, and that's my most exciting thing always. Now, Jesse Hoffman is a registered dietitian, assistant professor, and researcher in the field of human nutrition. Her dietetic and research expertise are in gastrointestinal conditions and the gut microbiome. Additionally, Jesse is passionate about scientific and nutritional science communication and does so regularly through social media, from breaking down nutrition science to busting myths that are so prevalent in today's society. She strives to empower individuals to become responsible consumers of social media content and experts in their own bodies. So let's dive in and learn some things from Jesse. Jesse, thank you for taking the time and being here with us. I know I just kind of stalked you and then asked you if you wanted to come on this podcast. I just love what the information and the way that you're delivering it on social media and Instagram in particular, I think is very interesting and going to help just break down a lot of these myths and nutrition and what's going on in this world for people. So we just really appreciate you taking the time and being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I mean, the myths are so pervasive and it feels like I answer the same questions again and again and again on social media, but I sit there and remember that so many people are getting new to coming to my page and are finding the same myths are still being like passed around, even though I'm like, I busted that one like years ago, but just their myths are just so pervasive and they come in rounds. Like they'll die for a little bit and then they'll come back, which is frustrating, but like kind of wild.
Exactly.
And I think that just kind of proves the point of what you do and, you know, what we do in the movement and pain space is there's always going to be nearly an unlimited amount of people out there that are searching for their quote unquote solution for the problems or the health issues that they're experiencing in life. And again, that's why we're so appreciative of what you do. So I kind of want to dive right in on some of these myths and current present day. What would you say is the one you get the most questions about and the one that you can kind of bust right here and now for us?
It definitely fluxes a lot. The one that I've gotten a lot most recently, and I actually even made it like ended up falling, you know, getting into the Instagram algorithm and starting to make a few reels, even though it's not my thing. But I made one about artificial sweeteners in the gut microbiome the other day, like the just belief that they're just, oh my gosh, so toxic to your gut, like they're going to destroy your microbiome and your gut health. We really don't have evidence to support that. Like our research currently says, like, yeah, maybe when you consume artificial sweeteners, there is a change in your microbiome. But aside from like wellness influencers and what they like to promote, a change does not necessarily mean it's a bad thing. It just means there's a change. And what I think a lot of people don't appreciate in the field is that the research in microbiome science is like so young and compared to like so many different other sciences. We are just beginning to scrape the surface of our understanding of like what the microbes in our gut really do, their functions, what even a healthy microbiome looks like. So the idea that artificial sweeteners destroy your gut microbiome is currently, you know, I'm always willing to change my stance in the future as research comes out, but it's currently false. We don't have evidence to support that. So, you know, as always, you don't want to overdo everything. You don't want to exclusively be consuming diet sodas as your only liquid source, but like having a Diet Coke because it makes you happy and it tastes good is perfectly fine. It's not going to destroy your gut. Having some artificial sweeteners that exist in those food products is perfectly fine. It's not going to destroy your gut. We'll kind of get into this as we kind of go into like a lot of these different myths, but people like to harp on these like nitpicky details and get really caught up on these little tiny individual like minutiae without looking at the big picture and addressing the things that really impact gut health, which are things like eating a diverse diet, making sure you're getting enough water, making sure you're getting in some daily movement, taking care of your mental health, sleeping well, like things like that. People like to get caught up on like those quick fixes and little things and demonize different food components when it's really like the compilation of everything that really influences gut health.
Mm-hmm. I'm super glad you said that, because I think that's one thing that a lot of people won't argue, right? We like to, maybe there's one study or one thing that someone likes to grab and take out of context and then just say like, oh, artificial sweeteners wreck your gut, when in reality, the things that are going to be most impactful on our gut health are some of the things you just mentioned: eating a very plant-filled diet, focusing on your sleep, focusing on, you know, drinking enough water, moving your body a little bit. And those are going to be so much more impactful than focusing on these tiny little discrepancies that we might be seeing in very early research, like you mentioned, on the microbiome. If I ask a follow-up question to that, you said we notice changes. Can you speak to some of the changes that we might see in, you know, consuming artificial sweeteners, what that might actually mean? And also, you did kind of mention the doses in the poison. So maybe you're not exclusively drinking Diet Coke throughout the day. Are there differences in, or has there even been research done on the volume or the amount of artificial sweeteners that people consume and what that does?
Yeah, so I'll answer with a highlight of the frustrations of microbiome research, and that every study shows something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And that's because we all have, like, our microbiomes are so inter-individual. We also have, like, our what we consider a quote-unquote, like, healthy, normal microbiome differs based on location. So what we consider healthy in even one region of the U.S. might not be the same in another, just because environment is a big influencer on the microbiome. So a big downfall to a lot of microbiome research is the ability for things to be replicated. So what some of the research has shown with artificial sweeteners is that some research shows that we have a reduction in what's called diversity, which diversity of your microbiome we know is really important and good. It's nice to have a lot of different diverse microbes in our gut, because they all perform a lot of different functions. And so if you have a lot of different ones there, we're making sure we're getting all the functions that we need them to do. So there has been some research that shows like a reduction in that diversity, but there's been some that's shown an increase in it. So it's not really conclusive. And without getting into like specific tiny bacterial functions. I mean, like, I could nerd out with a microbiome scientist about this all afternoon, but I really don't think that's super helpful to anybody else. But I would just say, in general, the changes are not clinically meaningful yet. So nothing that I would like raise a red flag with. It's not like you're getting an abundance of like this really pathogenic microbe that's blooming in the gut or something like that. They're just inconsistent shifts.
That's interesting. And going back to the poison is in the dose, we still don't know then how much that would mean. And what does it mean to have a diet soda every now and then? Is that once a day? Is that once a week? Is that, you know, what does that really boil down to?
So I will say a lot of the research that's been done in artificial sweeteners and the gut has been done a lot in rodents, because we start a lot of our research in rodent models. It's safer. We don't want to immediately jump to things in humans. But a lot of the research that showed detriment to the microbiome, we're using like doses of like, I mean, you would have to consume like hundreds of diet sodas a day in order to reach that threshold of like where you started to see detriment or functions. And that's the same when we talk about like artificial sweeteners and like cancer risk too. All of that research has really been done in rodents, and it's super high doses that you would never be able to achieve as a human. But the research is still important, and it's still something we want to look at further. But I would say, like, we don't have like concrete evidence of like you should have no more than X number of diet sodas a day. But I would say, like, if you're drinking more than two like a day, I mean, and this is speaking to myself too, because sometimes I do that, like, grab your water bottle. Like, I know it doesn't taste as good and it's not carbonated, but at least grab your water bottle, grab a carbonated water, sparkling water or whatever, and try to, like, I mean, just for, we know it's, you know, having water is important, and we don't want diet sodas to, like, crowd that out necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's good. That's nice to be able to hear and kind of break down.
Yeah. And I think moving into kind of another myth or something that I think is just a really common and pervasive term that comes up a lot, it's this whole concept of the leaky gut. And I think people have just started kind of using this as a blanket term for, oh, I've got leaky gut, this or that. Can you break down like what leaky gut actually is or is referring to? Because then on the other side of things, I've seen people put online like, oh, leaky gut isn't actually a thing. So is leaky gut real? Is it just this mythical word that people like to use when people start having gut issues?
Leaky gut is absolutely real. The problem is, and this is like consistent for so many different things in nutrition, gut health, even fitness and things like that, is that it's been like a real scientific phenomena, has been overtaken by like fitness influencers and wellness influencers and just like functional practitioners and things like that, and kind of adapted and used improperly. Leaky gut, to backpedal, is a real scientific thing. Instead of calling it leaky gut in the scientific field, we tend to call it intestinal permeability. Leaky gut is intestinal permeability are the exact same thing. It basically means, so to anatomy and physiology lesson, in our gut, we have all of these different types of cells that line our gut. Most of them are epithelial cells. So think about kind of like the cells that are on that form like your skin. You basically have some of those in your gut and they line up really tightly together and they have all of these different components that really seal them together. So we don't want things to pass through the gut that aren't meant to pass through. So certain things can pass through. So things like glucose and different amino acids coming from the digestion of protein and different fats and things. But we have mechanisms to get those across that barrier. Yeah. Whereas we don't want things to just leak through that aren't supposed to be. So you also think about, you have your gut microbiome in your colon predominantly. If those cells are leaky, you're having bacteria go across that barrier and into circulation, which if you get too much of that, you get something called sepsis, which is not good, not viable with life. You're in the hospital, big, big problem. But the concept of leaky gut is that some of those functions have started to break down. You also have other things like mucus layer, a mucus layer that lines the gut too, that helps protect. So when you start to have kind of the erosion of that mucus layer, maybe some of those proteins that link those cells together become weak or faulty, you get these like essentially like holes in your gut. The gaps between those cells just become larger and quote unquote leaky. So things can leak through that aren't supposed to be. So leaky gut is absolutely a thing. The problem is we don't have a mechanism to really measure it clinically in a manner that's meaningful for individuals to be diagnosed with leaky gut. We can do it experimentally in a lab. It just becomes really difficult, and we've not fully validated a method to do that like in a clinical setting with your doctor. So yes, leaky gut is absolutely a thing. And aside from the reason people get concerned about it, aside from me mentioning that the microbes can get into your circulation and cause things like sepsis, which is really, really big deal, the idea behind it is you can develop something that's more low grade, where little amounts of things that aren't supposed to be in your circulation are crossing that barrier and getting into circulation and causing like low grade inflammation, which we associate low grade inflammation with a lot of chronic diseases and metabolic conditions. So that's really where people started getting concerned about leaky gut, is like, well, maybe the gut's responsible for type 2 diabetes, heart disease, all these other chronic inflammatory conditions that are associated with that kind of low grade status of inflammation over time. But backpedal a little bit, leaky gut, absolutely a thing, not a thing that can be diagnosed at this time. And it's a little bit tricky to talk about because there are transient fluctuations in our gut barrier. So we can have a little bit of leakiness and that can be perfectly normal. For example, after exercise, it seems to be our gut is a little more quote unquote leaky than normal. And then it returns back to its normal state. And so we don't necessarily think exercise is a bad thing. But it's kind of like exercise produces a little bit of an inflammatory stimuli, which is not necessarily a bad thing either. And your body kind of adapts to that. And that's part of the mechanism by which it kind of helps you. Leaky gut is one of those pervasive myths that is not diagnosable. There's nothing that we know that, you know, really can cure leaky gut. And no one should really be diagnosing it at this point in time.
That's really just interesting to hear, because it is something that I think is thrown around a ton. And people will just say, well, I have leaky gut, or I've been told I have leaky gut. And knowing that that's not actually something that can be confirmed right now or diagnosed, you know, that's really super interesting. And kind of leads into, I'm glad you brought up exercise, because this is actually something I dealt with, and I saw that you talked about it as well. Exercise-induced gastrointestinal distress or the syndrome. Yes. And I remember if I hadn't been running or doing intense cardio, like steady state cardio for a while, I could only go not long. And then all of a sudden my stomach would just start to hurt so bad. And I kind of had to gradually work through that state for over a period of time before it would completely go away and I could go do runs and go do cycling for a long time. But it would be something that, I mean, I remember going to a cycling class with my mom and having to leave 30 minutes into it and go to the restroom and felt like I had to go, but I couldn't. And it was just like, so it is a distress. So what is actually happening?
Yeah. So a side note, I deal with that exact same thing and I still deal with it. I was a big runner. I ran cross country in college. I ran marathons during grad school. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden my gut just was like, nope, not anymore. We're going to cause some GI distress after running. And it takes a lot of training to get over that. And sometimes I'm not willing to go through, you know, that training period to get over, you know, some of those bad symptoms. But there is good news there is that if you do struggle with exercise-induced gastrointestinal distress, a lot of times you can train your gut to handle it. But the reason that this occurs is so many different reasons. Number one is when you are doing exercise, and predominantly we see exercise-induced gastrointestinal distress, we see this in cardio-based activities. So cycling, endurance running. Endurance running is really the most common one. But anything that's really, you know, even things like CrossFit that are a little more high intensity, like you can have distress from that as well. But the mechanisms really are because when you are exercising, you are requiring a lot of oxygen and blood flow to be diverted outside of your gut. Your body is in a state of, we don't need to be digesting food right now. We need the nutrient or like blood flow elsewhere to keep our muscles moving and, you know, keep oxygen pumping to those muscles. So it diverts your blood flow from your gut, which basically can cause some of that cramping, can cause some of that irritation feeling. And then also just the mechanism of jostling, just like when you're running, you are bouncing up and down. Mm-hmm. Your stomach is bouncing up and down. Your intestines inside of you are bouncing up and down. And so with endurance activity, that long-term jostling can irritate the gut. And a lot of times individuals have things like internal hemorrhoids. That jostling can irritate some of those hemorrhoids. So individuals may feel that urgency afterwards, like they need to go and then nothing's coming, or they do go and they see some blood, things like that. That's super, I mean, I don't want to say super common, but like relatively common in runners and individuals like that. With cyclists, we often see more upper GI symptoms. So you think about like the position that you're in when you are like hardcore cycling, you're bent over. So a lot of times you'll see that like that basically GERD, so reflux. You'll have some of that reflux of that stomach contents. You might have a little more nausea and vomiting from things like that. But there are absolutely things you can do to train your gut. Time is very important, kind of just getting some more training time under your belt, going low and slow. So keeping that heart rate really low, training for a lower intensity and trying to increase that time can help too. And then there's nutritional factors that can obviously influence GI distress. And so that's something a lot of runners and cyclists and individuals doing exercise have to kind of figure out, like what settles good on my stomach. Things that are, you know, really high in fructose may cause some irritation. So things that are full of high fructose corn syrup that you may grab as like a quick carb source sometimes cause some GI distress. So oftentimes a mix of glucose and fructose is really good because you have two different substances that are going into your gut that utilize different transporters. And so you're getting that carb effect without kind of overloading your gut and causing some of those GI symptoms. So there's, without going into so much detail, there's absolutely things you can do. There is a great book that is written by a fellow PhD RD called The Athlete's Gut. And so it basically goes into all of this in detail and things that you can do to kind of train your gut and different factors that influence it. It is absolutely great. And I will send y'all a link so you can link it as well. I have several copies in my office that I give to students because we do some GI research in athletes in my lab.
That would be really helpful to be able to link down for people. And I mean... It's kind of exactly like you said, it took me time, you know, it just starting low intensity and building it up. And then I did have to start looking at what were the foods that I was putting in because it would have an effect on what I felt if I would then go running after that. So it's just so interesting that I kind of had to try to figure that out on my own without really having the resources or tools to to know what this was or what was going on. So I love that you just, you broke that down and you're going to link up a resource. That'll be really helpful. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I'm enjoying about what you're saying so far is like how integrated and interwoven our gut is to all of our systems, and being able to have some of that interoception or insight into what am I doing? What have I ate? How have I slept?
Yeah.
What kind of fluids am I drinking? And how am I moving my body? And what does my gut feel like after that? And I think that that's the type of non-sexy solution that is really difficult to get people to buy into when it's like, okay, you might need to take 2-3 months of experimenting with your movement, what you're eating first meal of the day, and then before, during, and or after your movement, in order to start to tease out what works best for your body, because how individualistic it is, because you know how that can be transient and change from day to day or month to month and throughout life. Something that didn't bother you when you were 20 might be the worst thing, you know, as far as how your gut feels when you're 40. So I appreciate how your answers are weaving in a lot of just this insight and kind of self-checks, self, you know, tests that people can do on what works best for them.
Yeah. And then you add another layer. Individuals who menstruate are often like the fluctuations in hormones are going to cause GI symptoms. So even me personally, I notice that there are certain times throughout my monthly cycle that I cannot go for a run because I will absolutely have GI symptoms. And there's different things like that. So it literally, your gut is impacting everything and influenced by everything. So something that I always kind of talk to individuals that I've worked with on, you know, some of their GI, like, gut health and habits is like, we keep track of everything that you would like holistically think of as like wellness, because if there's so many aspects that are going to go into gut health. And so, you know, like we mentioned, like sleep, movement, hydration, diet, hormones, just like stress levels in your life, you know, how much are you sitting per day? There's so many different things you can keep track of to kind of look at your gut health. And so that's always a great place to start if you're looking into kind of lining up different symptoms with your gut and trying to learn more about your body, is kind of being more in tune to your body and kind of taking note of all of those different factors can kind of help you learn more. And definitely with more time, you start to learn more things, because I certainly didn't make the connection between hormones and my GI symptoms when I ran until I was like started tracking them. And I was like, it seems like this time every month I'm going to have GI symptoms if I go for a run. So it's definitely crazy. Like taking my own notes and telling myself to go like look at my habits and look at how my body's reacting.
Oh yeah. And speaking of like going based on, you know, your menstrual cycle and stuff and what happens, especially as a woman on a month to month basis, you know, I know that there's different kind of bloating, especially as a woman, that we might face. Now, what is normal bloating and what is bloating considered that we need to be kind of concerned with and something that is, you know, I guess that's my question. When is it bad? When is it something that's kind of normal, and how do we know the difference?
Yeah. So it's going to differ a little bit for everyone, like as is everything. But like what I like to, the line I like to draw is it causing you pain and discomfort? Like, I mean, obviously, like your stomach protruding a little bit after you eat a meal is going to be a little uncomfortable because you're like, oh, my clothes look a little like my stomach looks like I'm sticking out. But like if it's causing like physical discomfort, some pain, and if it's interfering with your daily life, that's when I start to say, all right, well, maybe this is a problem. And if it's like not going away in like a normal amount of time, the big thing that I see and I've seen for years is people equate feeling bloated with being full. And so like you eat a meal, that food has to go somewhere. Your stomach is going to obviously be a little bit distended. It's not just like poof and it's into your cells and you have all the energy. You have to break that down. You've just put a lot of food into your body. It's got to go somewhere. It's going to take up some form of space. So you're going to see distension after you eat a meal. Bloating is really that uncomfortable. A lot of times it's a lot of gas buildup. And you're going to look several months pregnant a lot of times if you have some extreme bloating. It's going to feel a lot of times like you ate a massive Thanksgiving meal and it's going to kind of stick around, and it's going to feel like very uncomfortable. Like you can't really get comfortable where you're sitting or standing and things like that. So that's kind of where I like to draw the line, is where when you have that kind of physical discomfort, and making sure that people are taking note that just being full after a meal and having a little bit of distension is perfectly normal. But when it persists and it's occurring even outside of a meal, that's when we start to kind of get a little concerned and say, hey, maybe we want to look into something here.
Mm-hmm. And kind of going along that thread of what I would say is more so adverse reactions to eating certain foods. I know that mm-hmm. something that has started to become very popular is food sensitivity tests. And
yep.
people saying, oh, you should go and get a food sensitivity test that can start to tell you, you know, which foods you might react poorly to. And I know there's definitely different qualities and methods of testing for food sensitivity out there. Can you kind of break down what those tests are actually showing us and if or when they might ever be beneficial?
Yeah, so currently, so there's a big difference between what we consider a food allergy, which is an allergic immune mediated reaction that's going to manifest a lot of times as airway obstruction, hives, swelling, things like that. You're going to know if you have an allergy to something.
Yeah.
So individuals that have allergies are often going to know, and it's not going to really typically manifest just in your gut. So we're going to put that one aside. It's usually not an allergy if it's just manifesting in your gut. An intolerance is, think of something like lactose intolerance. That's basically, we don't have enough digestive power or enzymes to really break down a food component that we're putting into our body. So lactose intolerance is super common. We tend to naturally lose this lactase enzyme as we age. And so a lot of us will notice that as we become adults, we may not be able to digest dairy products as well. And that's because a lot of our lactase starts to kind of go down. And that's not true across the board, but a lot of individuals have that. And so that is an intolerance. And so when we don't have those digestive enzymes to break down foods that we're putting in our body, those foods pass through our GI tract untouched by our enzymes. And when they reach the colon, or the large intestine where a lot of our bacteria absolutely have the enzymes to digest things like lactose, and they love to. So when they break it down, they produce tons of gases and things like that. And those are the symptoms that you're feeling when you have an quote unquote intolerance to something. And you can have intolerances to other foods too. There's things like fructose intolerance. And then we can consider where we start to move into food sensitivities is a lot of times they're kind of an intolerance, like you're not breaking down foods as well. But it's been this like term that's kind of been marketed as like, oh, you have a sensitivity. And a lot of times the symptoms of a food sensitivity are just GI manifestation. So like maybe you have some gas, bloating, diarrhea, things like that. Where it starts to become a little tricky is a lot of practitioners now also say you're going to have brain fog if you have a food sensitivity, which I hate using the term like brain fog, because what does that even mean? Even things like fatigue, like, well, fatigue is going to be subjective. And if you're really, truly having fatigue, you're not getting out of bed at all. You're like super tired. It's not just that, oh, I had a long day, like I'm tired. So a lot of individuals are twisting this to now say, well, if you have brain fog or fatigue, you have a food sensitivity or something like that. There are not valid tests currently to assess food sensitivities. The ones that are on the market rely on a mechanism called an IgG blood-based test. So IgG is an antibody, and it is a memory antibody. So it is an antibody that essentially, if we test your blood for that and its reaction to specific foods, it's saying, those tests are saying, hey, I've seen this food before. Hey, wow. I've been exposed to this food before. That's not really saying you're sensitive to it. Maybe some of those tests just by a fluke find something that you're actually having issues with, but the mechanism behind like the actual IgG blood test are not currently valid at this point. And that's not to say that we won't have a mechanism to test for food sensitivities later, but the tests on the market currently are not valid. And the thing that I really hate is a lot of these companies are then taking to the next step. They're doing the food sensitivity test. Sometimes they're doing a microbiome test at the same time, and they're sending you back. They're like, oh, well, you need to eat X, Y, and Z based on your microbiome coupled with this food sensitivity test. And we absolutely don't have evidence to support that right now. So it really is leading people down like a restrictive path, which can, you know, lead to some not great habits with food, maybe even like at the worst case scenario, like an eating disorder. So there are things that we don't really want to promote right now. But you can absolutely have adverse reactions to foods. And so what I always recommend is you work with a dietitian that's trained in that area. And what we typically will do is an elimination diet and kind of figure out what foods are aggravating you. Some of the most common symptom or most common foods that are going to cause some of these symptoms are things called FODMAPs. So FODMAPS stands for basically, it's an acronym, but basically it stands for fermentable short chain carbohydrates. So without giving you the full list, they are basically fermentable, just meaning our microbes can break it down and produce a lot of gas. And so a lot of these things that are considered FODMAPs are things like lactose and fructose. So things that a lot of people already don't digest that well. But then things like inulin or chicory root, which we see in a lot of health products with added fiber. And then the last, the P in FODMAP stands for polyols, which are things like mannitol. So those are those sugar alcohols. So all of those, in some individuals, reach the large intestine, your bacteria ferment it, they produce a ton of gas, and that causes those symptoms of kind of a food sensitivity. And so what an individual can do if they're working with a dietitian is we can go on a low FODMAP diet, which is a phased elimination diet. It's not long term. It's just to help identify some of those food components that may be causing you issues. Because most individuals that have a sensitivity to a food, it's oftentimes one of those FODMAPs that are causing some of those adverse GI effects.
Mm, that's a really good way to put it. And again, working with a registered dietitian, someone who can actually really help to guide you through this, not just someone who's saying that they can, I think is really, really important and something that, you know, Dom and I in our own field, you know, try to push and promote as well. It's working with a professional who actually is trained and knows in that area of expertise. It's just so important, because then we go down the route of like, now all these products that come out, especially around the new year or something, are detox products.
Yep.
What does that mean? And when someone is trying to say, oh, you need a detox, like they're saying, you know, you need a whether that is a juice cleanse or whether that's a whatever kind of cleanse.
Charcoal and cayenne and lemon juice cleanse.
Yeah.
Detox is one of those that I kind of mentioned in the beginning, that things just kind of like come around. Detox is one that has never died. It is just like reinvented itself. And so now it's kind of like the most recent thing is like gut health detoxes, because you need to detox your gut, apparently. Spoiler alert, your gut is a detoxifying organ. It will kind of do it itself. So basically, detox is pretty much a big, big fad. I mean, aside from like you ingesting like a massive amount of like pharmaceutical or like chemicals and you need to actually go to the hospital to be detoxed. Like, you don't need to detox yourself of things that you just encounter every day, like foods. And I mean, like the environment, you don't need to detox yourself of those things. You have organs within your body, so many different organs, like your liver, your kidneys, your GI tract, everything that detoxifies itself naturally. Your body is perfectly equipped at detoxifying itself. It doesn't need an extra boost. Those juice cleanses and detoxes that you can buy, a lot of the times they're just glorified laxatives. So either you feel lighter because you're not intaking solid food in the case of a juice cleanse, or you feel lighter because you're intaking like a laxative tea or something that's causing you to just like excrete absolutely everything. And then you feel, you feel de-puffed and de-bloated and detoxified because your stomach feels flat. But in reality, you've just done a glorified colonoscopy prep. Like it's not detoxifying yourself in the way that you think it is. So detoxes are absolutely fads. Scams, like you don't need to buy anything that's going to detox. The best thing you can do to support like your natural detoxification systems is just to eat a diverse diet, drink enough water, I mean, get some movement in, because your skin is a natural way of detoxifying yourself as well. You don't need to give your body like an extra push and buy fancy supplements to do that.
So you're telling me that most of the products that tell me that I'm going to be detoxed are just utilizing my own body's detox systems to get all the stuff out anyway.
Correct.
Next layer to that question, because I've heard people talk about this too, is this concept of using binders to get things like maybe heavy metals or other quote unquote toxins that our body doesn't naturally eliminate well. And again, I'm very naive in this area and don't know a lot of the science behind things like this. Is there any credibility to that type of claim?
So it's one of those things, again, that like, yeah, certain scenarios we may need to use those things, but that's like a clinical situation where you have like you jumped into a vat of chemicals. Like, I mean, it was usually an occupational exposure of some sort. Some people, you will build up heavy metals in your body and like it can happen. But a lot of the analyses that are used for that, like some hair analyses and different things like that, are not really valid. They're used by a lot of practitioners that aren't really doing valid things. And it's a little sketchy. There is a lot of fear mongering around you've been exposed to these heavy metals and they can cause all of these complications. But that's just to be truthful. That's not something that most people are experiencing. It's a thing that can happen, but you will probably have symptoms when it does happen and you'll need to seek out like actual medical attention. And there are things that they can do to help you out in that arena. But the regular individual does not need to be seeking out getting rid of heavy metals in their body through some of these like binders and different things.
Well, and then it just comes back to the basics. I mean, and I feel like this is where we always come back to. Are you sleeping enough? Are you intaking enough water? Are you moving? You know, all of these baseline things that I think we don't really want to have to address because we want the quick fix or we want the thing that's going to be the fancier.
We are the one-stop shop for non-sexy solutions.
So it's I mean, I love that it's continued to be reiterated throughout this podcast episode. So it hopefully is something that, you know, doesn't have to be so complicated. If you do feel like you have something that's complicated, seek out a registered dietitian. Now, some people might be listening to this and say, okay, well, are you working with people? Is this something that you're doing? Can people reach out to you? Or are you not taking on clients right now? How is that all working?
So I take on a few clients every now and then. I'm not currently taking on clients, but that being said, if people reach out to me, I usually am able to direct them to some of my other like colleagues and things like that. And so if people do reach out to me, I usually do direct them one of those ways or say like, hey, I'm going to be taking clients in the next month or so. If you want to wait that long or here, you know, you can, here's my colleague that also takes clients. You can check with them too. So just due to my schedule, I'm a professor. I teach students too. So I have to kind of limit the amount I do outside of that just for my own mental health. And to give clients the best experience they can and most attention. So I do keep my roster a little bit limited. But I do often do just like one-off consults, a couple of appointments, things like that to kind of help people get on track with some of those just easy questions and things like that.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being a resource, both to your students. I mean, you're educating the communities out there, but also educating future educators and dietitians and health professionals. So appreciate everything that you do, Dr. Jesse Hoffman. Where can people go? I know you have an ebook online. Where else can people go to learn more about you or learn more from you?
Yeah, so I have an ebook that I wrote with Dr. Gabrielle Fondaro, who is an excellent another resource in microbiome and gut health science. Highly recommend. I'll have that linked for y'all that you can check it out. I am most active on social media, so my handle is JesseHoffman_PhD. I do Wednesday Q&As every week, and I've done it for like 3 or 4 years now. Consistently. So if you have questions, pop them in my box on Wednesday. I try to answer as many as I can without giving like specific prescriptive medical advice because we can't do that on social media. But I try to answer the most common questions. And I have tons of like really detailed posts on my page that answer most all questions. Prebiotics, probiotics, leaky gut, artificial sweeteners, the low FODMAP diet, anything you ever wanted to know about gut health, I probably have a big post on my page about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much and there's so much we could have gone into even more on this podcast, but I appreciate just some of the myths that we got to really unpack and break down and hopefully help people understand these things a lot better. And then obviously, please go check her out on social media, Instagram, follow her, and you'll learn so much more. So Jesse, thank you so, so much for doing what you do, being here with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been fun.
Another great podcast and guest who's really able to talk into some of the areas that Jen and I just aren't experts in. If there's something during this episode that you absolutely loved, please share it out with a friend, share it out with a family member who you think might benefit from it. And if you've been listening, please consider leaving us a rating and review on your favorite podcasting platform. Of course, you can always go down to the link in the show notes and join up with our Gen Health
movement community. Gen Health is your space where you can find all of your easy solutions for movement, pain, and restrictions that you might be feeling in your body. And of course, we will see you next time on another episode of the Optimal Body Podcast.